Welcome. And I can't help feel like welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island changed nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. So not only fluoridated, it's also incidentally irradiated from Fukushima, and everybody got a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb to help the economy. My very special guest today is the honourable, the fabulous, the famous, and the indomitable, G. Edward Griffin, who has a number of different websites from gedwardgriffin.com, freedomforceinternational.org, and also realityzone.com. He's an author of a number of different books, including what many consider to be the definitive book on the creation of the Federal Reserve, The Creature from Jekyll Island. Also a good book on vitamin B17 called A World Without Cancer. And he's a basically person who opposes collectivism and promotes individualism because, well, basically, if you're a collectivist, you don't believe really in individual rights or liberties. And if it's a free human race that you want, well, basically, you got to make sure that it survives. Because there's not very much point having a survival of the human race if it's not a free one. G. Edward Griffin, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Vinny. I really like being indomitable. I think that's the best one of those words.
I was once described as inimitable. Which I thought was a really awesome word.
I don't think I can even pronounce it.
Yeah, it means incapable of being imitated, I think. Oh. Inimitable.
Oh, yeah. That sounds good. I'm ready for that.
Yeah. Something like a cave that has mittens in it. Inimitable. I think, anyway, welcome to the show. It's been nearly 2 years since we had you on the first time. And since then, you've produced a number of different documentaries and helped out with the guys at Free Your Mind Films with The Great Culling and What in the World Are They Spraying? And, basically, you're kind of one of the godfather figures of the truth movement kind of thing. And it's really an honor to have you back, mate.
Well, thank you, Vinny. I really appreciate that. I guess if you live long enough, that's what sort of happens to you, but I appreciate that. Thank you.
So, can I ask you what's on your agenda these days? Because honestly, I haven't been keeping up with the play.
Well, my agenda is broken into two parts. There's the one part of the things that I really think are the most important to do, and then there's the other part, which are the things I just must do because I'm committed and I'm carried along. And the most important things, it seems, represents about 2% of what I'm doing, whereas the other represents about 98%, which is a source of great frustration for me of late, because I keep thinking, you know, time is short. And as you know, I produce a weekly news service called Unfiltered News, and I think it's very important. We have a lot of subscribers now all over the world, and get a lot of positive feedback. And yet it takes up a lot of my time, and I'm thinking nowadays, you know, news reports are sort of like, well, newspapers are here today and they're gone tomorrow, they're in the trash next Thursday. But books, some of them at least, hang around and may have a transgenerational impact. And so I'm feeling very, very frustrated lately in that I'm not really working on the book, what I consider would probably be my last book, if I ever get it done. So I sense that the meaning of your question is what's important with me at the moment. And I think what's most important right now is to try and get all of this normal day-to-day business out of the way as quickly as possible and finish this book, which tentatively is entitled, you know, The Future is Calling. And then you mentioned the magic word yourself a moment ago when you said collectivism. Most people, unfortunately, I don't think really know what that word means. They may have heard it. Most people have not heard it, actually, in the modern generation, which was quite common several generations ago. But anyway, to me, the great battle that's going on in the world today is the battle between collectivism and individualism. And if one understands that, really understands that, then I would guess probably over 90% of the great confusing issues of the day would be cleared up in a heartbeat. Because you can understand that the motivational forces that are at play in these conflicts of the day are between individualism and collectivism. And so to answer your question, going from the long form to the short form, is I'm really trying very hard now, Vinny, is to wrap all of that topic up in that final book and get it published, hopefully, in the next, certainly before the year is out.
Well, I've found that your books have become sort of iconic in the truth movement. I remember one time when, what was his name? You went on mainstream media with some big commentator guy. I forget his name now. It escapes me. And you regarded as somewhat of an authority on the Federal Reserve. And if you had to really point a finger at something that is so capable of taking away individual liberties and essentially bundling them into collectivism, I would say a financial institution that has the ability to create mass amounts of money out of nothing would probably be one of the central figures of this. Would you agree?
Yes, oh, definitely. That was perhaps an act of great good luck, or an event of great good luck for me, because when I started to take an interest in the Federal Reserve and in monetary issues, I knew it was important, but I had no idea of any how important it was. I had no idea in the early stages of that when I made the commitment to pursue it. I had no idea of how deep the roots were and how far they traveled underground before they came up again in some other form. And so it was lucky that I did decide to jump on that issue, because when I was done, almost in spite of myself, I had produced something which was far more valuable than I had thought it would be in the beginning. And the reason for that is, you just mentioned, this money issue touches everything. It's what makes the world move. I think it's a powerful, certainly as strong as gravity. And in the course of human affairs, it motivates people, perhaps not quite as much as fear, but the desire for reward expresses itself in money. Because with money you can, acquire just about anything. So that's the carrot and the stick issue that humans have always responded to, and I guess beasts of burden too. But the stick, you can endure the pain, but the carrot looks awful good, and it drives humans and other animals on to great lengths. And so if you happen to be the person or the group that produce all the carrots, that gives you tremendous power over getting humans to do what you want to do. And I hadn't really focused on that part of the equation. All I knew is that everybody wanted money, and money was important and all of that. But the financial issues and the monetary issues turn out to be probably one of the top two or three at the most issues that can motivate the affairs of mankind.
And one of the others being fear. What are the others?
Well, fear, of course, is a general term. We fear illness. We fear cancer. We fear terrorism. We fear crime. We fear poverty. We fear being looked down upon by our fellow human beings. We fear being left out. We fear all of these things, and those who would manipulate us, use all of those fears in nudging us to do this and to do that or not to do something, because they tell us, well, if we just give up our freedom, why, now we won't be secure from terrorism. We'll be safe from terrorism. They say, well, now if we just give up control of the Internet to these wise and trustworthy politicians, now we don't have to worry about pornography reaching our children and so forth. So they play upon all of these fears and get us to nod, say, okay, yes, I guess we'll give up a little bit of this, we'll give up a little bit of that, but in return we want to be protected against that thing of which we are fearful. So those things take many forms, and one of the things I had in mind when I said that a moment ago was just the force of military power. I mean, it used to be that, you know, nations were conquered by other nations, and the way you acquired control over people was to build an army and just march in and destroy the existing political system, take it over, replace it, and now you have the new nation. That's old style. Today, it's done through the mind. Very few areas are conquered anymore strictly through the bayonet. It's done now through the mind. It's done through propaganda. It's done through education. It's done through financial means. It's done through the power of the group, wanting to belong, and all of those things. The power of advertising. Just think of what people can do because they saw an advertisement on television. And so all of those things, the control of man's mind today, that's where the power really is. And I was thinking about that recently, how far our knowledge has progressed in the last 100 years of how to literally control men's minds through the education we give them and through the constant media exposure that they have. We can literally change their attitudes. We can engineer their opinions. And we can get them to do the most dastardly things, and they think they're doing good. And I was thinking about how far that art has progressed, or that science. And I'm sure, you know, in the next 100 or 500 years, it's going to progress even further, and it's kind of scary when you think about it.
You know, what's interesting is yesterday I was watching a documentary called After the Tribulation, about how in the Bible there's no mention of a rapture, and there is mention of a second coming and things like that, but it happens after huge quantities of persecution and death and famine and all of that kind of stuff. So what I found was very interesting is nowadays to admit that you have Christian beliefs is actually something people are very afraid to do because they're afraid of being persecuted. And it's not just those beliefs. It is whole rafts of different beliefs that people have, you know, belief in freedom, belief in individuality. These things are ideas for which people now get attacked for having. And in so doing, we censor ourselves. The mind control is unbelievable.
Yeah,
when you realize that people can actually stop themselves from doing what they feel is right and admitting what their own beliefs are for fear of repercussion.
Yeah, well, that's the power of that new science that I was referring to. You can get people to act or not to act depending on how you reach their brains, their minds. And so that's the world in which we live. And that's the dark side, of course. But, you know, the bright side is that to change all of that doesn't require, it certainly doesn't require 51% of the population. The people who are directing this very shadowy development that we're describing, they number probably less than 1% of the population. Think about that. All of this is being done by less than 1% of the population. And the other 99% are simply responding to it. There's probably a couple of percent in there that 2% and 3%, they know what's going on, and they're cooperating and participating and becoming maybe the mechanics. They become willful volunteers to make it happen because they're well rewarded. They're in on it in a way, but they're not the originators of it. But certainly 97% of the population are completely victims of it. So that's the bad side, is that 97% can be manipulated by 3%. But the good side is that it only takes 3% to break that, too. So maybe that's where people like you come in and are more important than you might realize, because you're reaching out and you're reaching that 97%. And they may be thinking that what you're saying is a bunch of garbage for now, but as time goes by, they'll remember, oh, yeah, I heard that garbage 6 months ago. Well, you know, it's not garbage. It's the truth.
Now, I was talking on a radio show just before doing this one today about the Occupy Wall Street movement. They had this chant, "We are the 99%. And what I found very interesting is that it's usually 1% of the people who do 99% of the work. and 99% of people who only do 1% of the work.
So, that's true also, isn't it? Or at least the useful work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they may as well hold up a sign that says, "We are the ones who do the least amount of work. Give us something for it."
Yeah, that's right. It works both ways. And, you know, actually, those numbers are way, way wrong. It's absurd to say we are the 99%, because what they really are the 99.99%. The people that they're complaining about are not the 1% at all. It's the 0.001%. You know, the super wealthy. But anyway, that's not important. That's sort of cutting a hair. But the number,
exactly,
that strata is very, very small.
Yeah. Well, ladies and gentlemen, just think about this. You don't have to be the 99%. You only need to be the 1 or 2 or 3% in order to really make a difference in this world. Name me a time throughout history where the majority made a difference. Can't find it. It's usually a small, determined minority that really changes this world for the better or worse. Take responsibility. We'll be right back.
I stand alone against your mad, deadly, worldwide, conspiratorial, gangster, computer god communism with wall-to-wall, deadly gangster protection, lifelong sworn conspirators, murder, incorporated organized crime, the police and judges, the deadly, deep parroting puppet gangsters using all the gangster deadly Frankenstein control. These
welcome back,
sneak deadly gangsters, the judges and the police trick.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the show that's all about snake parroting puppet deadly gangsters. And speaking of the 99%, I remember when Occupy Auckland had a big march. I had this little recording on my megaphone that I was going around playing. I just kind of wanted to play this for you, Ed. I thought you might find it funny.
Thing, you know what I'm saying?
I don't. Could you hear that well enough?
Well, I heard it, but I wasn't quite sure what I heard.
It says we are the 99.999%.
Yes.
It's a fractional reserve thing. You know what I'm saying?
Yes. Yes. Right. Well.
And okay. I had this idea as well. Anyway, moving on from the show time aspect of it is that, when you want to go out and get something done, don't go out asking for people to help you do it. Try and do it by yourself. And only once you've realized that it's not possible for you to do it by yourself, that's when you start to include other people.
This sounds very philosophical. I think that's based on actual life experience.
I've been left in the lurch by a number of people, and I've realized the importance of self-reliance. If you don't rely on yourself, you're going to rely on somebody else. And ultimately, reliance on other people is about, really, dependence. Whereas I think it's actually better to collaborate with other people on an independent basis and create something together that's bigger than both of you, rather than one person trying to do something and expecting everybody else to do it their way kind of thing. I don't know. This is just something I've been thinking about recently.
Well, I think you're right, Vinny. It depends, of course, somewhat on what it is you're trying to do. If you want to improve yourself, that sounds to me like that's pretty much a job for you alone, with maybe some input from your friends. But if you want to change the world, you start with yourself, but you can't do it without the help of others, obviously. You know, it's the old idea that when two people work together, they can accomplish the same effect as two people working separately. And if three people work together, they can do the work of nine separately, and so forth. It's especially with organizational work, political action, bringing about social reform, moving the nation and the society. Those things are done through collective action, and it's like a football team. You know, you take 12 guys out there in the field, and they've got all the moves, the plans, and they work together. They got the signals, and they practice. You put them on the field and put 50 or 100 people against them, and those 12 are going to just move right through that 100 with no problem at all, because the 100 are not organized. They don't know what they're doing. They don't have a common goal. They don't have a leader. You know how that goes. So I think it depends on the goal, whether the individual is the most important or the collective. But now there's that word, and that's what throws a lot of people, because, as you know, I'm probably about as big an opponent of collectivism as they come. And some people will say, well, you believe working collectively, don't you? And I say, yes, but that's not collectivism. According to the dictionary, you know, collectivism is a collective action, but it's done by compulsion. That's the very nature of collectivism, is that there's no freedom of choice involved. Just because you're an individualist doesn't mean you have to move your piano alone, but it means that when you want to move your piano, you call on your friends and you ask them to help. Say, I'd like to have your help with this, and really would appreciate it, and I'll either do something for you, or I'll pay you, or whatever, but I'm requesting you to help me. But under collectivism, they say, no, this piano needs to be moved. You, and you over here, move that piano, or we put you in prison. You know, so it's a whole different thing. Just because people work together collectively doesn't mean that they are working under collectivism.
Well, see, teamwork. I've seen the politicians use this, and New Zealand's a big rugby loving nation, you know, and America's a big football loving nation. And I thought about it like this: the two different political parties that we have currently ruling our countries, they're actually playing on the same team. And when one is ousted out in an election and another is jumped in, it's not actually one team beating another. It's actually one person who was currently holding the ball passing it to the next person in their team, and they're still heading towards the goalposts.
That's right. Both teams have the same objective, and they have a certain camaraderie. There's not much difference. I can't speak about, you know, politics anywhere else in the world, but certainly in the United States, that's true. There's a lot of smoke and sparks between the Republican Party and the Democrat Party at election time. Campaign rhetoric is fierce, but when all of that is through and either one party or the other moves in, it doesn't take very long before people realize that nothing has changed. And that's because both parties are dedicated to the principle of collectivism. They're both collectivist parties. And one on the right, one on the left, they may have different rhetoric, different ways of accomplishing this, different groups that they appeal to. But when it comes to actual political philosophy, there's no difference between the right and the left. When you think about it, what's the difference between communism and Nazism? Philosophically.
They're both socialist, national socialism versus, you know, United Soviet socialism, whatever. It's the same thing.
Yes, same thing. The Nazi Party, the NAZI, stood for National Socialist Party. Yeah, they're all socialists. They believe in socialism. Socialism is merely a form of collectivism. Socialism, communism, you know, all of those things, liberalism, left-wingism, so many words that get in the way. The real root word is collectivism. And once you understand what that is, then you realize that that's the common philosophy to all of the political parties in the world today, all of them. Well, I shouldn't say all. That's a big category. There are a few little minor groups here and there, but they're pretty well marginalized in the press as being of no realistic importance. But 99, there we're back to that number again, 99% of the political action today is in the hands of collectivists.
Yeah. Did you know that 99% of statistics are made up?
On the spot.
Yeah. We have a question in here from the chat room. Do you think the New World Order is likely to fail given the current state of affairs, or will far too many people remain asleep to stop it?
Well, the New World Order is already here. It has already succeeded. It's here. I think that's the first thing that we have to wake up to. I don't think the time is going to come when they'll announce it in the newspaper that next Thursday or next Saturday at noon, they're going to ring the bell and the New World Order is here. They've been building it for quite a while now. Probably, I would say, for about 100 years it's been under construction, a little bit at a time. And we're just getting used to it. And we speak, at least in America, we still speak of the free enterprise system and capitalism. But we haven't seen that here in decades. It's just something they talk about. But you don't see it. It's not in government. It's not in our society anymore. So collectivism has been built, the New World Order, the internationalization of all of these collectivist nations around the world coming together, slowly stitching up the pattern so that each nation gradually becomes merely one more patch in the quilt, the international quilt. That's been going on for a long time. So I guess the question you're asking is that can it be reversed? I mean, it's not total yet. That's for certain. There's still some wiggle room, and that's what we're all hoping, that we can not only wiggle but make that room bigger. So there's still hope. But the question I think that was being asked is, can this process be reversed? And there's no doubt in my mind that it can and that it will be. The only question is, how long will it take? I remember when I was a young fellow, I remember hearing the old-timers say, well, you know, this is going to take a long time to reverse this process because it's been a long time in coming. You can't just turn it around on a dime. And I remember thinking, oh, come on, these guys are old fogies. I'm in a hurry. We can do it. We can do it. We'll do it by next election, you know? Well, now here I find myself saying the same things now that I have a little more little wisdom behind me, a little more experience. And I firmly am convinced that it will take time. But I am equally convinced that we are actually laying the foundation now for that movement to become not just possible, but inevitable. Because young people today are asking questions, whereas in my day when I was one of those young guys, there weren't too many people asking questions. The only people asking the questions were the old fogies that were trying to preserve the status quo. Well, now the status quo is here. Nobody wants to preserve the status quo anymore. So now it's the young fogies wanting to change things. And they're asking questions, and they're getting it right. And maybe they have a little way to go, and like these people that want to occupy Wall Street or occupy corporatism or occupy this, that, or the other thing, they need to realize that they're calling for more government regulations and more government controls, when in fact that is exactly the problem. But at least they know that something is wrong, and they can be, you know, educated. They can see, wait a minute, we know who the enemy is, but we're calling for the wrong solutions. We're calling for exactly the same solutions that the enemy wants us to call for. More government, until finally we have total government. And that is that's the thing that came to mind a little while ago when I realized some of the, you know, the great people that are sponsoring your show and your supporters are coming from that movement. And I love those people. I work with them. I'm with them all the time. I love to participate in their rallies. But I have a little fun sometimes pointing out to them that sometimes, not always, but sometimes they're calling for more government regulations of this, that, and the other thing, when in fact those are the very things that their opponents want them to be calling for.
Mm-hmm. And I always found this very perplexing as well. In order to propose any kind of solution, you need to more fully understand the problem that you're trying to solve.
Yes,
and
yes, that's it.
People look at the problem on the very, very surface. They don't see the huge amount of pollution that is just underneath the water. They don't see the giant logs that you could possibly dive into that are just beneath the little surface of that river that you think is clean and pristine.
Yeah.
And
good analogy.
What I find is interesting is that I said this on Facebook the other day, Ed, and I want to get your take on it, is that traditionally, when people unite, it's not because they all just individually came together and magically formed organizations and things like that. It actually takes leadership, real leadership, people who are capable of organizing, understanding, incorporating others so that you can form them into a cohesive unit. Not to say that leadership is the method of controlling other people, but it's actually helping other people to realize that they have the same goals.
Well, I think that's true. Leadership is neither good nor bad in itself, because as we know, there are some very powerful leaders who have been dictators, who have been tyrants, but yet they're magnificent leaders. That's how they got to be in charge of everything, is because they hoodwinked the masses into supporting them. And the way that kind of leadership works is they find a common enemy, or they create a common enemy, and they unite the masses in their hatred. They say, you must hate this group or this thing, and therefore you must unite behind me. And of course, that's what Hitler did. He played the hatred of the Jews quite well. Stalin did pretty much the same thing. He played hatred of the proletariat, hatred of the capitalist class. And in both cases, the masses were driven by hatred. They were repelling against something, and they never asked what it was that they were working for. And see, that's the danger. It's easy to unite people and lead people in their hatred. And that's what we have today, the politics of hatred. Here in the United States, if you ask people in this last election who they were going to vote for, was it Romney or was it Obama? Whichever one they said, it wasn't because they liked Romney or Obama. It's because they hated the other guy. It's the politics of hatred that drives people, unfortunately, at least in modern times, it seems. And so back to the issue of leadership, you can have leaders that will play upon that and lead the people in the wrong direction, or you can have leaders who will not play upon that and will, just have no axe to grind, just be interested only not in further enslaving the people, but releasing them from bondage. And that's pretty hard to find those kinds of leaders today.
Well, namely because the people who desire power go into leadership positions when somebody who wants to lead people to freedom isn't usually the person who desires a great amount of power for themselves. They simply want other people to have power for themselves so that they don't have to be responsible for everybody.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. There's a good lesson for us who want to leave people alone, that maybe that's not necessarily the best thing to do. I mean, not that we want to coerce them, but we certainly have to get up off of our couches and get out there in the arena and off in leadership.
We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen.
On December 16th, 1961, the world turned upside down, then inside out, and I was born screaming in America. It was the tail end of the American dream, just before we lost our innocence irrevocably, when the TVI brought the horror of our lives into our homes for all to see. I was told when I grew up I could be anything I wanted. A fireman, a policeman, a doctor, even president, it seems. And for the first time in the history of mankind, something new called an astronaut. But like many kids growing up on a steady diet of Westerns, I always wanted to be the cowboy hero. That lone voice in the wilderness, fighting corruption and evil wherever I found it, and standing for freedom, truth, and justice. And in my heart of hearts, I still track the remnants of that dream wherever I go in my never-ending ride into the setting sun.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest today is G. Edward Griffin. His websites are gedwardgriffin.com, freedomforceinternational.org, and realityzone.com. Now, Ed, you were talking about how you were doing a weekly news report and how when you do the news, it's like the newspaper, you know, it's here today, gone tomorrow, that winds up simply occupying a landfill. And I'm of the opinion that if something's new to me, then it's news. And I generally don't like listening to the news to a large extent, or even shows that cover the news. I want to know things that I don't already know that actually are really meaningful to my life and valuable. I mean, it's far more useful, I find, than just constant updates about how we're all screwed.
Is that a question? I guess you're right. I have to agree with that. I think we have an obligation to stay up with the news so we know what's going on in the world. But once you do know what's going on in the world, it doesn't take a lot of exposure to the news because you say, oh, yeah, that's more of the same. That was going on. That started 2.5 years ago, and I see they're still working on it. And you just sort of keep up with it. Those who don't understand the underlying forces may have a little more difficulty in recognizing what the news means because it seems to be detached. But, I'm in agreement with you. Even though I deal with the news and I work with it every week and we produce what I think is the finest online news service available, still, I don't like it because it's very depressing and I find myself having to explain the same things over and over and over again, which I don't mind doing because I'm hoping, and I believe it's true, that there are always new people out there reading my stuff for the first time. So I always pretend in my mind's eye that I'm talking to somebody that just took a new interest in all of this. So I try to be very understanding and patient and put myself, back a few years when I needed someone to explain all of this to me. But still, yeah, it gets to be tiresome. The news, without an understanding of the forces behind it, can be almost a waste of time. And especially if you have no plan and no ability to make any changes or do anything about it, then it almost gets to the point where you say, well, why do I want to follow all this bad news? So what? I can't change anything.
I have a perfect example here. Girlfriend comes home and she says, Vinny, did you hear about the car bomb that was rigged up in Times Square? It was going to kill a whole lot of people. And without even looking at any of the information, I said, oh, don't worry, baby, it was probably just the FBI. And yeah. It turned out that it was.
Of course. How many times does this have to happen before people get the pattern? Of course. You must have a credible enemy. You must scare the heck out of the American people if you want them to go along with the loss of their liberty. So it's very much in the interest of those who want to pass this legislation to take away our liberties. It's very much in their best interest to keep us afraid of terrorism, even if they have to create these guys themselves. And they go out and find these numbskulls. They probably load them up with drugs, and they give them money, they give them explosives, and say, we caught them just in the nick of time. I mean, how many times does that have to happen before you realize that's the way they do it today?
Have you noticed how the more you watch and the more you figure out about the world, there's a danger of becoming, what's the word, jaded. Have you ever felt jaded, Ed?
Well, jaded, of course, is another word for a cynic, I suppose, and both of those have negative connotations. I prefer the word skeptic. I think I'm an extreme skeptic. I don't just automatically assume that what I'm hearing in the news is really the whole story. So I guess that's jaded. That's bad. But you know, when you use words like jaded and cynics, that means you've already passed judgment on it. So anybody that is such as I am, an extreme skeptic, I wouldn't use those words. I just say I'm realistic.
Yeah, not taken in by the hype. And speaking of hype, have you ever noticed how there's lots of these movements that are springing up all over the place to great fanfare and huge public attention and a lot of interest and things like that that just amount to nothing? Why is that?
Yes, that's the nature of our news, yeah.
I have this great concern that in the future, people will stop paying attention to positive news because they're so jaded of seeing so many things rise up with positive fanfare only to simply disappear into nothingness.
Right. It could well be. That's the dark future that could develop. I'm thinking back to the elections recently here in the United States. To me, the two most important issues that could possibly be discussed that would help you to understand where a candidate stood on issues that are really going to affect your future profoundly. Those two issues would be, where do the candidates stand on the Federal Reserve, which is the creation of money out of nothing, and the expansion of the money supply and the destruction of the economy through inflation, all of that. That's a huge issue for the future of America. And the other one, where do the candidates stand on the surrender of American sovereignty to international groupings, treaties, and finally to the United Nations? Is America, or any nation for that matter, going to continue to exist as a real sovereign nation, or is it? Are you in favor, sir, if you are elected? Are you in favor of having America or any other nation absorbed into this new world order, this international world government that's being created? Those, to me, were the big issues. I can't think of any bigger issues. And yet, neither political party in America would discuss either of those issues. They talk about anything else, but not the two most important issues.
They have pre-approval processes. Are you going to ask me a question that might make me look like some kind of a scumbag if I don't answer it properly? Yeah, well, I'm not going to invite you to this debate to ask those questions then.
Exactly, yeah. That's how it works. So
That's the position of the media, I found, is to ask those tough questions and to deal with the consequences of them regardless. Like, to basically, I found that the role of the media is to have no loyalty of any kind to any group. Loyalty only to one concept, the truth.
That's what it should be. Somewhere along the line, I saw a nice affirmation of the professional principles of journalism. I don't know whether it was drafted some years ago by the American Journalist Society or some such organization, but I heard them, and I thought, boy, these are profound. If they would just, if the media were to follow those rules today, we'd have a very strong counterbalance out there against all the lies and the deceit. And one of the principles that was included was this absolute loyalty to only the truth, you know, and not try and shave the truth or twist the truth to favor one's own personal opinion. Just report it the way it is. Well, we don't have that. Haven't had that in a long, long time.
Yeah, I think I read the same list as you did, and I was looking down this, and I was like, whoa. You know, I've never had any training in journalism of any kind. And unwittingly, for the past 5-6 years I've been doing this, I was following to the letter all of these principles of which I had no awareness. And all of the media that I'd been watching, mainstream media at least, in this country of New Zealand, had been following none of them. And they had all the training in the world.
Well, you know, it's kind of invigorating when you can do that. I've tried to follow those principles with our unfiltered news service. And usually it's pretty easy because the news is twisted in some way. Or actually, I find more often than twisting of the news is the fact that the real essence of the news is omitted. They'll have a lot of facts, a lot of details, a lot of this, that, and the other thing. But as to the why, that's completely missing. So it's been kind of a challenge and fun for me to dig into these stories and say, well, wait a minute, why are they doing this? And then I come up with a couple of options, and we discuss the options and sort of leave it to the reader to decide, what do you think is the motivation behind this? Things like that. It's very invigorating to be able to do that. But every once in a while, you come up with some stories that really do not favor your personal views, you know? You can have heroes like everybody else, and you can have the good guys, and you think you know what should be happening out there, and by golly, it turns out to be, well, your guy's not so hot after all. And it's hard just to swallow that and say, well, I was wrong. At least this fellow made a mistake this time, but you got to call attention to the mistakes even of your heroes, at least if you see them as mistakes. But if you can do that, and you're prepared to back up your reasons for your opinions, it gives you kind of a good, clean feeling. It's like taking a bath, you know, and getting rid of all of the mud. You can hold your head high And people may disagree with you, and sometimes they'll even point out to you why you were wrong, okay? So what do? You swallow your pride and say, well, according to John Smith, who wrote me this letter, I've changed my mind. He convinced me. And here's his letter, and here's why I changed my mind.
We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, and we broadcast 5 days a week, 2 hours a day on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. We film a webcam of the show and upload those after the day is over to Mr. News Guerrilla Media, the YouTube channel, which has... And the New Zealand listeners will love this. More subscribers than the New Zealand Herald TV channel, which is undoubtedly the largest mainstream media source on the web in New Zealand. And I'm beating them by myself because that is how much popularity the truth truly has. You're either involved deeply in this movement, or you're really not involved at all. My very special guest is the illustrious and various other nice adjectives guest, G. Edward Griffin. A lot of people ask what the G stands for. It stands for George. His father and his grandfather before him were named George as well. He kind of got tired of that tradition, so he kind of goes by Ed. Welcome back.
Thank you. Yeah, that's quite true. Not many people know that the real moniker is George.
Yeah. See, I'd always thought that it just was just for being just so straight gangster that you just go by G. But
yeah,
it's not the case.
Well, you know, when I was a kid, a little small kid, they had a little song they sang. You know, Georgie, Porgie, Puddin' and Pie, kissed the girls and made them cry. And when the boys came out to play, Georgie Porgie ran away. And I hated that song. So if anybody started to call me George, I made it very clear to them that my name was Edward.
Well, you must have been a real heartbreaker back in the day, man.
What?
You must have been a real heartbreaker, you know, a real hit with the ladies.
Oh, I broke my own heart many times, I know that.
Well, so thinking about this in terms of relationship, are you married?
Oh, yes, yes. I've been married to the same woman for over 50 years.
I had this conversation the other day with Pastor Lindsay Williams and a Wall Street trader named Tom Filer. And we were talking about just when you're a man who's trying to do great things with the world, usually you cannot do it without a really supportive, loving partner who's really with you step by step, every step of the way. When you're single or promiscuous or something of that nature, the safety and security of a strong, faithful relationship just isn't there.
It sure is a great help, and you've heard it said 1,000 times, and I believe it's true, and I'll say it too. I could not have done it alone. Not that the it is anything in particular, but I don't think I could have had a contented, a self-fulfilled life, and I agree with you totally. I think one is half a number.
Mm. I am really concerned, though, about a lot of other people that are along the same vein of thought that we have who are in relationships that the other half of their relationship doesn't get it, is still asleep, as it were. And I couldn't imagine what kind of a pain and frustration that would be. I've never had to deal with that.
Yeah, the pain and frustration of what, Vinny? I missed that.
Of being with somebody who just doesn't get it.
Oh, I see what you mean. That would be very, very difficult. I know many people who are in that situation. And I can tell you, from what I can see, it's a great strain on everybody. And often it leads to, a breakup.
Yeah. You know, this whole idea about waking people up, I'm of the opinion, Ed, that you can't wake people up. They wake themselves up. Nobody forced me to watch 100 documentaries and radically alter my worldview over a period of a few months, did they? You know, there's certain people out there who provide, waking up information, but you can't force people into it. And even if you could, you wouldn't want to, because it goes against the very principle of trying to free people.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. I often get a kick out of people. They're paying me a compliment, and I take it as such, but they'll write me a letter and they say, "This book, I just finished reading your book, Mr. Griffin, and I think this ought to be compulsory reading in all the schools." And I'm thinking to myself, I better go back and read it again, because I don't believe in compulsion.
What about recommended reading?
I'd like that. Yeah, strongly recommended reading, but not compulsory.
Yeah. I mean, and if it is compulsory, what are you going to do? Mark people down on just like, you haven't read G. Edward Griffin's book, this, that, or the other, you know?
And I understand that it's just a word. There are many different levels of compulsion. I get it. You know, when you send kids to school, you know, they have compulsory reading, and that's part. I go along with that. Or they're not going to get through the class, you know. But that's what they're talking about. But I laugh at the word, because I spend a lot of my verbal time and digital time talking about the evils of compulsion. But, of course, I'm talking about at the political level, not at the educational level.
Yeah. You have a conversation with somebody, and it's on the points you agree that you should come together and collaborate, right? And sometimes I ask people, look, we're going to try and find a fundamental disagreement. Are you going to put on a black ski mask and invade my home or something of that nature with a police badge and beat me to death in front of my family or anything? Are you ever planning to do that? Well, no. Okay, well, then there's not really any fundamental disagreements we're really going to have on, because we both don't like the idea of forcefully punishing people. And I have this concept that's been buzzing around in my head for many years, and I kind of wanted to lay this on you, is how exactly does a human being, and this, I've seen this happen in many, many people, suddenly decide that it's just not worth it, that people deserve their fate if they don't stand up against it? You know, I've spoken to many people in the truth movement who say, the sheeple deserve their fate. They deserve to be exterminated because they just don't see what's going on.
Well, I have to think about that a moment. I suppose what we're listening to is the sound of frustration. I wonder if they really mean that. I think deserve, you know, that word needs to be chewed on a little bit. Do any of us deserve anything that good happens to us, you know? There's a lot of luck that plays into that. You can climb to the top of the philosophical mountain with that word and ask, what do we deserve because of our own intrinsic worthiness and so forth? And if you want to follow that path, you usually come to the end of it and you say, well, we don't deserve anything because it was just all good fortune or because of our Creator or whatever. But in a different sense, yeah, people do deserve the results of their own actions. If they choose to do foolish things, they should expect foolish results. And so if they expect other results, they don't deserve it in that sense. I think that that expression, I even found myself saying it at one point in my evolution, and I stopped and analyzed it, and I said, you know, this is frustration. I'm angry with these people. I'm angry with them, and then I began to analyze it. You know, why am I angry with them? It's because I'm expecting too much from them. I think that if I were in their exact same shoes, with exactly the same upbringing, and the same influences in my early years and family and everything, there's a good chance I'd be exactly the same as they are. I know that's the old argument between, you know, what's ingrained, what's genetic, and what's culture, the difference between culture and nature and so forth. But I think we are mostly what we are, mostly, not entirely, because of our environment, how we were fortunate enough to be or unfortunate enough to be raised, and our role models, the people we were accidentally thrown in with, all of those things. And then I finally top off all that reasoning with the idea that we were talking about this earlier. Only 3% of the population will ever see it, ever get it, will ever assume that it's their responsibility to change anything. Most people are just going to be followers, and they will go wherever the leadership segment of society leads them. And so once I keep thinking back on that, and I came to the conclusion, well, okay, there are some people that are going to get it and some people that aren't. Most of them are not. And I don't necessarily say that that's their fault. That, you know, I'm not firm on that part of it, by the way. Maybe it is their fault. But I prefer to think they just happen to be in that 97% of the population, and that's too bad for them. Now, what I need to do is find somebody in that 3% and contract with them. Let's work together. Let's talk with them and form some kind of movement. And now we can change the world.
You know, that's quite an interesting way of looking at it, because I'm sure that during your time on this earth doing all these things you have done, you've incurred a lot of abuse, criticism, ridicule. We all do. We've all gone through it. And the way I've chosen to deal with it is to take all that abuse, ridicule, and criticism, take the bits from it that I feel are true. Yes, I have been a bit arrogant. Yes, I have been a bit flippant. Maybe I haven't done enough research or something of that nature. And then I'll discard the rest, because as soon as that person's abuse is really their only motivation, I realize that there's 7 billion people on the planet. I'd rather hang out with the very small minority of people who actually get me, who can actually help me, who actually inspire me, not you, sir. Yeah, I think well, this is about sorting the chaff from the wheat.
It's a perfectly natural and normal and healthy attitude. It's at the root of the word to discriminate. You choose to discriminate. People say, you mustn't discriminate. Well, that's stupid. To discriminate means to choose that which you prefer. It doesn't mean you have to be negative. People immediately think, racial discrimination means, they think, it means that you dislike a race. But it doesn't necessarily mean that. It may be true in some cases, but it's not true, I believe, in most cases. But you discriminate among your friends. People hang out generally with those of their same age. They discriminate against people who are very, very younger than they are, very older than they. They hang out with people of the same attitudes, the same sense of humor, the same preferences in music and in humor. They hang out with the same people, have the same hobbies, same language, same culture. I mean, this is natural. There's nothing unethical about discriminating as long as you're not discriminating against somebody because of something that, we choose to set our limits on that. We believe that you should not discriminate against a person because of their race. And I believe that totally. But I think you should discriminate against a person because of something that they believe or their character. If they're a thief, if they're liars, if they're untrustworthy, if they have a criminal mind, if they're brutes, if they beat little children and women, you better discriminate against them. So I guess my little plea here, and I got off on a shoot, is just that we need to be careful when we use the word to discriminate, because I think we all should be more discriminate than we are. And that all started with your comment that you like to hang out with people that think along the same lines you do. And I say, hooray for you. And we all should do that.
Mm, mm. And ironically, the way I think is completely out of control. There's no topic I won't broach. It's just I like to be honorable and friendly. I mean, really, that's it. You hit on something right there that is absolutely 100% on the money. It is not the color of somebody's skin. It is not the content of one's bank account. It is the quality of one's character.
Exactly.
That's what you discriminate on.
You should.
And if you don't, imagine the scum that you'll surround yourself with.
That's right. Well, whenever a boy and a girl get together and decide to be boyfriends and girlfriends or husband and wife, they sure expect their partner to discriminate, don't they? They say, you're mine, nobody else's. Agreed or not, and you better be discriminate.
See, and another thing, you know, like when the collectivists discriminate or something, I've had so many people, like, I tell really bad jokes, Ed, I mean, I must admit. And every now and again, I'll mention a group that perhaps has been discriminated against or something of that nature, not to insult them or anything like that, usually in the context of insulting something else, and I'll have somebody come up and violently, aggressively tell me that I shouldn't discriminate against these other kind of people. And it's like, well, hold on a second. I was doing something out of good humor, maybe in bad taste, and you're getting violent with me over it? I think you're overreacting, and you're taking yourself and or life far too seriously. Those are the things that I believe are the two immutable rules for living a happy life and not taking yourself down really dark paths of anger and rage and aggression and self-denial and hate. Don't take yourself too seriously, and don't take what other people say to you personally.
Yeah, it's easier said than done sometimes, isn't it? Especially if the other person is someone whom you admire and or is very close to you. Then it gets a little more difficult to be above it all. But still, that doesn't negate the advice that you just gave, because it's certainly good advice. And even among those friends of yours, it's good advice. It's just harder to follow.
Well, I think most things in life are easier said than done.
Yes, all the good things.
Yeah, that's right. The bad things are really easy to get into, you know, and they're easy to maintain. The good things, on the other hand, are freaking near on impossible to build, almost impossible to start, and yet we keep doing them anyway through persistence, vision, things, all those good things. And I think that if you do want to live a happy life, take the hard road, because the easy road doesn't prove a hell of a lot. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com.
And gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the Chateau de Rothschild on the sacrificial lamb, nice, beautiful barbecue area that we have for all the children that we sacrificed. I'm a very special guest who's a connoisseur of fine New York style kebabs and pizzas. It's G. Edward Griffin, the man with the plan and the philosophy and intelligence that we may need to overthrow organized crime in our time. Mr. Griffin, welcome back.
Thank you, Godfather. So nice to be back.
I was hoping that song would play, because I always do the Godfather impression thing, and I think we did that the first time we have. Yeah, I like the Godfather. I do. Anyway, I've been conscious of the fact during this interview, I've been trying to share with you some of my personal philosophies, and I don't think that's really what this really should be about, because I don't get to speak to you very often, and there is a lot of things that you've done in your life that are so important, that have realizations that really change perspectives for people in and of their entirety. And you've been around many years, Ed. What are some of the most important lessons that you've really discovered in your lifetime that you would wish for future generations to hold on to?
Well, that's a great question. It's a huge question. It opens up in all directions, doesn't it? I would almost beg off on that because I would like to have time to think about it. But, you know, there's certain things that come to mind that are pretty obvious. Most of my mental activity has been spent in political and economic and social affairs with a strong secondary interest in health matters, and because those are the things I've written about. So you can kind of divide that all up. Are we talking about politics and social issues or monetary issues? Human relationships, which is another category. Are we talking about health? And I think that everybody has their insights based on their own personal experiences about what to do, how to handle personal relationships. But the thing that I feel that I have a little edge over the average has to do with the political, the economic, and certainly the health issues, because I've had more time to pursue those, to read and research. It's like I've been in a lifelong class, like I'm enrolled in college ever since I was 20 years old, and I just keep going to class every day. And, you know, I realize that most people aren't that fortunate. They can't do that. They've got a life to live. They've got a job to pursue, a family to raise, and all of that. Unfortunately for me, that's been part of my profession. It's been how I pursue a job. And so I'd like to just focus on that for a minute. In the field of health, the most important lesson I learned early on was that health doesn't come from the pharmaceutical industry. That optimum health is really something that the body itself creates if you give it a chance. You've got a commercial on one of your sponsors there, by one of your sponsors, that says it pretty well. The body will heal itself. It just needs a little help. I would not have used the word help. What it needs are raw materials, you know. It's like a machine that makes cement. It needs to have sand and rock and some certain chemicals. It just needs the raw materials, and it'll make cement. But it was almost a shock to me to realize that all the dread diseases that we think about, the chronic diseases like cancer and arthritis and heart disease and all of the big killers, they're not caused by a deficiency of some drug. They're caused usually by a deficiency of some nutritional element that, for one reason or another, individuals are no longer getting an adequate supply. It may be because they have a lousy diet, because they're eating all these processed foods, the easy foods that are so easy to come by, but in the path of processing them, so many of these little micronutrients have been removed. Or maybe they're eating nice fresh vegetables and all of that sort of thing, but the vegetables are coming from land that has been tilled and producing those same crops for 80 or 100 years. And with each passing year, a little more of those micronutrients, you know, things like selenium that you never think about, are being drawn out of the soil and put into the food and hauled off into market and not replaced. Maybe the fertilizers that the farmers are putting down contain a lot of good things, phosphates, you know, some minerals, but not those little trace minerals. They're gradually being depleted. And so even people who are eating fresh vegetables thinking, I'm eating healthy, are gradually, with the passage of time, being exposed to lower and lower levels of essential trace minerals. So when that picture finally got clearly implanted in my brain, I would call it a real epiphany. it was a complete change in how I viewed seeking medical advice and medical help. It used to be that I'd say, well, let's find a doctor. You know, what does the doctor say? And then further research in terms of cancer, I found out that what the doctor says is what the doctor is taught. And what the doctor is taught, it comes from the curricula, which is determined by the donors of the money to the universities that teach the doctor. And those donors, for the large part, either are or are part of the pharmaceutical industry. So I found out, much to my amazement, that doctors are heavily biased in favor of pharmaceuticals rather than nutrition, man-made chemicals with patents on them that can be very profitable, and that the whole medical profession is geared in the direction of making people feel better after they have become ill. And notice I said feel better. I didn't say cure them, but feel better, because the medical profession treats symptoms. They don't necessarily are concerned about what the cause of this disease, as long as they can treat the symptoms and make you feel better and keep you on the drug for the rest of your life to feel better. Well, all of that, that was a very profound awakening for me, and I think it might have had something to do with my health. I'm pretty healthy for my age. Fortunately, I'm sure luck has had a lot to do with it. And my wife has been a great teacher and cook and nutritionist, and she's kept me on the straight path with a good diet and all of that. But part of it was my own awareness that you just don't go running to the doctor for a new drug every time you've got a cramp or a pain or a headache or something like that. So we'll just start with that one. Vinny, I would say that general awareness that health comes from nature, that it's a balance between the mechanisms of the body that you're born with and the input of certain basic raw materials, many of which are chemicals which we don't even think about. You know, they're trace minerals, and particularly. And enzymes. Sometimes we don't even have the enzymes that we're supposed to have because the food is too cooked and all the enzymes in the food are gone. Or because we've put food through the microwave, and the microwave process destroys the enzymes, and to some extent even changes the chemical composition of the food itself. So, again, I'm kind of going over the same ground. The more I learned that health, optimum health, I believe, comes from nature and the body's balance with nature. That was perhaps one of the biggest discoveries of my life, and has had one of the biggest and the most profound effects on my life.
I was just thinking about what you're saying about enzymes there. I came up with another bad joke. Maybe you should write a book called The Enzyme Prophecies.
Well, there are some very good books out there on enzymes. As a matter of fact, if any of your listeners are interested, they should come to our website, our Reality Zone website, and go to the health section, and you'll find a couple of excellent treatises on the role of enzymes, the variety of them, and especially on how easily they can be disabled through processing. And, of course, how to replace them, how to find healthy replacements for them.
I do recognize this, that almost everything that everybody consumes on a daily basis has gone through an enormous amount of processing, and it has almost nothing to do with food. What we consume nowadays is not food. It's food-like products.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Well, what can I say? I think everybody's vaguely aware of this, but maybe they need to think about it a little bit more to come to that kind of an epiphany that I had some years ago, so that I realized that this was not just a little exceptional coincidence here and there, but this was universal across the board and affecting our lives in so many ways. If they want to live an optimum life, I think they better get hip on that.
Indeed. I've always thought that health is one of the most important things. because what do people say when you're down on your luck and you've pretty much lost everything? What do they say?
Yeah,
well,
of course, they always
at least you still have your health. And yet, everybody worries about their health, and worry causes stress, which causes detrimental health effects.
Right.
Yeah. We live an ironic existence, don't we? And also, I wanted to ask you as well about just in terms of political ideology, which do you think is the most dangerous specifically, and maybe a historic example, versus what, in your opinion, might be the most promising example of a political ideology that works?
Well, yeah, that's the other area where there was a huge epiphany, and that, of course, it's hard to put in a bottle. It's hard to describe. It's hard to put just one word to it. But I'll try, and as best as I can describe it, it's an awareness of what are the ingredients that must go into a social contract one with the other. When people live together, they come to their culture comes to sort of an understanding of what is the right way to live with each other, what are the things that should not be done, should be done. That's our culture. And some cultures have a lot more freedom in them than others. But they're not. It's not just one thing. So it's sort of a potpourri of different relationships and different rules and different limits and so forth. But I finally boiled it down some years ago to this contest between the ideology of collectivism on the one hand and individualism on the other. And each of those has their own each of those points of view is based upon a series of subcomponents of concepts, and they're found in both sides of the debate, except they're 180 degrees out of phase with each other. And there aren't many of them. And it's something I think that the average grade school student could understand fairly well. Certainly a high school student would have no trouble with it. I'll give you just an example. The basic philosophy that divides these two camps is the role of the individual versus the group. And that's kind of implied by the word collectivism versus individualism. You can see right away where the division is. Collective involves the group, and individuals involve the individual, which is supreme, which is the highest unit of society. And collectivists believe that the group is more important than the individual, and that the individual must be sacrificed, if necessary, for the greater good of the greater number. To them, it's a numbers game. It's majority rules, all of these things we hear. It's the basis of democracy. If you've got a larger number, then you win. It doesn't make a difference what you do. You can do anything as long as you've got a larger number. And that's the basis of collectivism. Whereas individualists believe that the group doesn't even exist, when you think about it. There's no such thing as a group. Group is just a word. It's an abstraction. It's in the mind. It's an abstraction for the concept, the mental vision of many individuals. But group doesn't exist. It's a mathematical concept. You can touch individuals, but you can't touch a group. It's like the word forest. You can touch trees, but you can't touch a forest, because that's a mathematical concept, an abstraction. And so here's the division. Here we've got the collectivists that say the group is the most important element of society, when group doesn't even exist. Individualists say, well, what really exists is the individual, and that's the building block of society. And what is truly good for the greater good of the greater number, truly, is what is good for the individual. That's how you come up with it. Anyway, this is it's something worth a lot of thought, and any high school students for sure can get these concepts, but they have to be brought up in discussion. They should be part of our historical process of learning our history, learning where America came from, because when America was founded, it was a break from the traditions of the past. America, as far as I can tell, is the first nation.
Sorry, Ed, we're coming to break, unfortunately. We'll come back from break and let you finish your point.
To fly to New Zealand? By plane from New York City, it takes 22 hours. So from the Twin Cities, 19. I mean, I fly all
the time.
Welcome
back, everybody.
6 hours on a plane is like a lot. And 19 is...
Welcome back to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 5 days a week. Now, G. Edward Griffin is my guest. And what's incidental about this is that we just got ourselves a new kitten, and he's Ginger, and his name's Griffin. So I'm not sure if you can hear the purring. It was kind of named after you, and also the mythological beast that that eats people.
Oh, well, let's hope it's the latter and not the former.
I was thinking of trying to train him to hiss at financiers and scratch collectivists, you know.
Yeah, right. So, well, anyway, I was taking too long to cover that ground. I think probably if any of your listeners are very familiar with this, but the bottom line is that once it became clear in my mind that all of this hoopla, this political discussion and debate and argument and contest can be boiled down to a very simple concept, and that's the differences between collectivism and individualism, it became a lot easier to deal with issues, because when you apply the issues against these basic principles, there are no exceptions. They always can be resolved by what your political view, or your ideological views, really, I should call them, what your views are on that issue. If you're clear on that, then making a decision is really easy. You can cut through all the smoke and all the lies.
You know, there was a phrase, I can't remember what it is, but a republic is where 99% of the people cannot vote away the rights of the other 1%. In a democracy, 51% of the people can vote away the rights of the other 49%.
Yeah, that's about it. Mm-hmm. The analogy I like to use is a lynch mob. Now, people who believe in majority rule and don't want any further discussion of it then should certainly have no objection to a lynch mob. Because there's only one dissenting vote, and he's at the end of the rope. So there you have it. But if you say, well, wait a minute, even that one individual, even if that mob out there is totally convinced that he's guilty of some heinous crime, even so, that individual is entitled to a fair trial, a conviction by a jury of his peers and so forth, if that, in fact, is what was written into the Constitution. So republics always have constitutions. They have, in other words, republics have a set of rules, written rules, limitations on what the majority can do. That's what it's all about. And in the United States, that was embedded into our form of law when we had the Bill of Rights, which said that, you know, Congress shall pass no law restricting the rights, peaceful assembly, the right to bear arms, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and so forth. No law, meaning the majority shall not restrict in any way these things. Well, that's quite a difference. And how many political systems of the world were launched on that concept? And there are not many of them. As far as I know, the United States was the only one. Well, with the passage of time, Americans have lost any memory of those concepts. And unfortunately, many of them have lost any interest in those concepts. We've been put through a government school system. Now we come out thinking that majority should rule, and then if a president or a political party can win the election, then when, okay, all bets are off. That president or that political party can do whatever it wants to do. Don't even ask about rights or limitations. Hey, they won the election, didn't they? You see? Well, that's why so many of the founding fathers in America predicted that if they ever created a democracy, and they warned against it, they were not creating a democracy. They said democracies always destroy themselves. Democracies always end up in the tyranny of the mob. And they were right. So Americans have never heard of that. Most of them lost interest in it and so forth. But anyway, that's our task, is to rekindle an awareness and an appreciation for these principles. And it can be done. I see it being done. And if there's any one good thing that one can say about what's happening in the world today, that things are going so badly for so many people, that it's catching their attention, and they're noticing, and they're beginning to think about these issues. And let's hope that enough of them will catch fire with this, with the fire of liberty, the spark of liberty, that they'll actually want to become active in politics, to move into the political arena themselves, and to pull away control from the collectivists that so far have had an easy going of it. They've had no contest. Nobody's ever tried to unseat them. When you think about it, how many individualists have ever run for office? You know, individualists like you and like me, we tend to say, ah, politics, it's dirty. Who wants to mess with that, you know? Leave people alone. Well, we've run out of time for that philosophy, because when individualists stay out of the battle, that means there's no contest. That means the collectivists just move in easily. And that's why in every government in the world today, you'll find they're run by collectivists without exception.
Now, you were talking there about the idea of the mob, and you also mentioned the right to bear arms. And there was a story that I heard of a lynch mob that was about to lynch a black slave in a small American town, and a 14-year-old girl with a pistol that she didn't even know how to use held the mob at bay and saved his life.
Well, it's a great story. I hope it's true. That's the way it should be, you know? That's the way it should be. Guns, in my opinion, how many times have I said it? I don't know. But anyway, guns are dangerous. Guns scare me. The only thing more dangerous than having guns is not having them when you need them. It's that simple. Guns are not a problem in society. If everybody had a gun, we'd have less crime than we have today. I remember reading a very scholarly paper was produced by some graduate student at a Midwestern university, I believe it was, about gun violence in the pioneer West. And much to everybody's surprise, the statistics that he dug out of those old records was that the pioneer West in America was a very law-abiding place to be, because everybody had a gun strapped on their hip. And, yeah, we've seen a lot of Hollywood movies, you know, about the showdown at the OK Corral and these guys walking in the saloons and shooting each other up and all that sort of thing. Most of that was Hollywood. When everybody was armed, there weren't so many criminals walking around shooting things up, because everybody else would shoot back and they'd be dead. They knew that. So anyway,
That was the reason why Jesse James and Billy the Kid became famous, because they managed to pull off more than one crime before being killed.
That's it, exactly. And they had a pretty good gang too. And also, I believe if you go back and look at the record of Jesse James and Billy the Kid, the areas where they were most successful was where the population had pretty well disarmed. They had already, you know, said, "Oh well, we got a sheriff now. We'll let the sheriff take care of it." Well, sheriff can't take care of it with 30 guys right into the town on horseback and loaded, you know, ready to go. That's where you need everybody armed. So anyway, I don't know how we got started on that, except to say that one person with a gun, like that little 14-year-old girl you mentioned, can save a life and can prevent an injustice. We don't get the stories every day somewhere in America. There's a story of someone preventing a crime because they were armed, preventing the loss of a life. Every day, I'm sure that's got to be true. If not every day, pretty close to it. As you said before, statistics, 99% of all statistics are made up. But we know, I mean, I see the stories coming through at the alternate media, not in the major press. We know that people are preventing crimes and saving lives with guns every day, but we don't read about it in the paper. All we read about it is when lives are lost because one person had a gun and nobody else did.
Yeah, that's pretty much the short and the curlies of it, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, you see Obama saying we need to take people's guns, and then you see his re-inauguration parade surrounded on all sides by armed protectors.
Yeah,
trying to convince us that we don't need guns to protect ourselves.
Right. Well, I think people are waking up to the charade.
Let's hope so. Well, we only have about a minute or so left in the show, so if there's any final words of wisdom that you'd like to bestow either on me or on the audience,
gosh, I don't
know.
If you just take the word wisdom off, it'd be easier. Well, the final word I'd like to leave with you, Vinny, is that I want to thank you for the show you've been putting on. For how many years now have you been doing this?
This is coming into the third year of doing particular show.
Third year. And I know it takes a lot of preparation and as you said earlier, a little bit of flack now and then. So I want to thank you for that and keep the faith and send people all over to see us at realityzone.com and freedomforce.org. And if enough of us get together, we can literally change the world.
And it doesn't take a cast of thousands.
No, it doesn't.
Mm-hmm. All right. G. Edward Griffin, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for your time today. And I know that you don't do a... I know that you're actually kind of trying to take it easy these days, and for you to come on the show is actually really, really special for me, because you're one of my heroes, essentially. And I believe that without you, this entirety of the truth movement would not exist in its current form. And I know that you've been doing it for so many years against all the odds, and still come out on top. And that is an encouraging thing.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Lenny. Benny, it's very, very kind of you to say that.
All right. Thank you very much for listening, ladies and gentlemen. And check out G. Edward Griffin at the website freedomforceinternational.org and realityzone.com. I'm Vinny Eastwood, and you can check out the archives for this show at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com, americanfreedomradio.com, and the webcam versions, where you'll also see the kitten behind me, at Mr. News Guerrilla Media, the YouTube channel. We'll see you again sometime.